And thank you for inviting me. It's an immense honor to be here. And I'm quite excited and nervous to talk about Hume in this country. So this paper actually, one version of it has been published in the Hume Studies, the last number that came out a few weeks ago, but it's I'm continuing to work on it, and so it's in continuous progress. In the paper I explore some strands of the new science of man proposed in Hume's treatise, focusing on his account of personal identity or the self and of the passions to the extent they figure in this account. What is the view of self with regard to the passions examined in Book 2, and how is it supposed to complement the view of the self with regard to thought and imagination, which is discussed in Book 1? I argue that the best way of understanding this is by taking the analogy of the self and the Republic or Commonwealth presented at the end of Book 1, what Hume describes as the true idea of the human mind, seriously as a political analogy. It brings in a holistic perspective where more than mere causation and resemblance are at play in structuring and linking together the system of changing perceptions, explaining whatever imperfect unity and identity it can have, which is sufficient for the moral psychology and ethics developed in books 2 and 3. So you have a handout. The paper consists of four parts, and the first part is about Hume's problem with the self and its identity. So the view that Hume directly targets in the treatise 146, it's on the first quote on the handout A, that I'm not going to read, is some version of the idea of a simple immaterial soul substance, perhaps a Lockean interpretation of the Cartesian soul. Hume rejects it on the ground that it fails to stand up to the empiricist tools of analysis he brings to bear on the experience that its defenders appeal to. All he can find in quote B is a bundle or collection of different perceptions which succeed each other with an inconceivable rapidity and are in a perpetual flux and movement, end quote. The mind is compared to a kind of theater where perceptions pass, I quote, pass, repass, glide away, and mingle in an infinite variety of postures and situations, end quote, appearing and disappearing without any simplicity at one time or identity indifferent. Before giving his account of why we nevertheless, quote, supposed ourselves possessed of an unviable and variable and uninterrupted existence, end quote, Hume makes a point in quote C to separate two questions, that of personal identity as it regards our thought and imagination, and two, as it regards our passions or the concern we take in ourselves. Leaving consideration of the latter for later, he notes that his discussion, the present discussion, concerns the first. Now there's controversy among commentators on what the question and the answer really is about, metaphysical selves or fictional ones. Hume's answer to the metaphysical question, as I understand it, is negative. There is no simple self over and above our perceptions, which do not yield any pure unitary thinking thing or substance. But it has also been argued that Hume, having rejected the metaphysical thesis about the nature of the mind ascribed to some philosophers, advances another positive thesis, claiming that the mind is a bundle or mass of causally related distinct perceptions. That is, it would seem, the only answer that a strict application of understanding and imagination according to his rules can yield. However, offering a new metaphysical thesis about the nature of the mind would be at odds with his methodology and skepticism concerning rational theology and psychology, which wouldn't lend support to any metaphysical thesis about such abstruse matters. Yet at the end of the section of personal identity, he does outline, with the help of another analogy, what he calls the true idea of the human mind, to show how the different and distinct perceptions are linked together by cause and effect. To get clear about Hume's own view, one would need to settle on what the notion of mind or self that he works with, the one he rejects as well as the one he retains, is. I take the target of Hume's negative thesis to be a mind or self in the narrow sense of a unitary entity given to rational intuition. I will call this mind, in a narrow sense, the inner sense, an empiricist version, perhaps, of the Cartesian mind. This is the self that supposedly has perfect identity and simplicity, which Hume also seems to use mind or self in a broader sense in Book 2, where it is seen as complex and changing, reflecting or expressing the body and its changing states or qualities. Hume has already dispensed with the thesis about the immateriality of the soul that is discussed and made fun of in the previous section in the treatise 1.4.5. The immaterial substantial soul would have been an ideal locus for an enduring individual simple self and backed up by a venerable philosophical tradition. But as Hume shows, we have no notion of substance, self or mind distinct from particular perceptions. Presumably, what he calls the self with regard to thought and imagination, consisting in heaps or bundles, is Hume's placeholder for the inner self, a composition of perceptions available to inner introspection. Since contiguity is Since contiguity is said to play no role here, Hume explains that this belief, maybe it was the 7 minutes that time is up for. He explains that this belief is the product of the mind's operation according to two principles of association, those of resemblance and causation, giving priority to the latter. Thus, in the text under D, the true idea of the human mind is the idea of a system of different perceptions or different existences which are linked together by the relation of cause and effect and mutually produce, destroy, influence and modify each other. The most proper comparison he can come up with here is the famous Republic or Commonwealth. In the last passage, 4 under D, Hume suggests, referring to the two questions distinguished before, that our identity with regard to the passions serves to corroborate that with regard to the imagination by making our distant perceptions influence each other and by giving us a present concern for our past or future pains or pleasures. Now, before considering just how this second complementary aspect taken up in Book 2 supports the first, I want to note briefly 2 points about memory that Hume seems to take for granted. First, whether memory here is understood as something like a storage place for the ideas and impressions that get associated, or as a power, disposition to revive past impressions, it is a condition for the laws of association to do their work, both for discerning causes and effects and picking out resemblances to be associated. The second point is, memory repeats the structures and situations of the perceptions appearing in the bundle. Look at where I have forgotten the letter, but it's the quotes under the second part, the role of memory. The third quote on page 3. The chief exercise of the memory, as long as it's fresh and lively, memory preserves the original order and form in which its objects were presented. And he says in this quote, the chief exercise of the memory is not to preserve the simple ideas, but their order and position. If we depart from that order, it is due to some defect of this faculty or its exercise. Imagination is at liberty to transpose and change its order of ideas. But we are not at liberty to change our memories, which can haunt us also when we'd rather forget. If imagination can easily separate one impression from another and treat them as distinct or recombine them in a different order, memory, as long as it works, cannot. I remember the insult I received, my anger, and regretfully my overreacting to it, with the ensuing breakup of a long friendship. Since the liveliest of all our impressions are those of our passions, of pain and pleasure, sorrow and joy, they, more so than other perceptions, keep reappearing and or being repeated in their original order and positions by memory, continuing to affect our present train of thoughts, feeding into our ongoing concern for our past or future pains or pleasures. Now, a question debated in the literature is whether Hume is working with two different selves. One narrow, the self of thought and imagination, and a broader one, the self of the passions. One could think of the first as a philosophical idea of self, and of the second as an embodied, natural or moral self, perhaps. Yet the passions crucial for the second are by no means absent from the Book One account of self or mind, but are listed in text F, down on page 3, right from the start among the perceptions succeeding and entering into associations with one another. Thus, in reporting the view he criticizes, Hume writes, the strongest sensation, the most violent passion, say they, instead of distracting us from this view, only fix it more intensely and make us consider their influence on self, either by their pain or pleasure. What Hume objects to here, as I understand it, is not that passions influence the self by their pain or pleasure. On the contrary, he takes that claim on board, but that we could perceive a continued self apart from the train of passions, bringing it into our view. The impressions that make us constantly aware of ourselves are a succession of affective sensations and passions, as witnessed in the last part, in the second part of the quote F, which I'm not going to read. The role of the passions, which belong to our affective nature, is not discussed in Book One, which is focused not on feeling, but on thought, that is, on the associations of ideas and impressions. The passions are reflective or secondary impressions, whose anatomy, nature, causes and effects are not examined till Book Two, starting with the account of the indirect, self-concerned passions of pride and humility. In this sense, then, both, for instance, Annette Beyer and Terence Pennell-Holm, who discuss this, seem right that the Book Two analysis of passions completes the Book One account of self-identity. If it completes it, it cannot be a different idea. However, both also seem to agree that the Book One account shows that the idea of a unitary self is a fiction. Should we then conclude that the Book Two account of the passions strengthens or completes the fiction? Are we supposed to think, for instance, that the passions increase or support the fiction of a unitary and simple self, that the operations of understanding and imagination, together with what Beyer calls our mental inertia, have created? One worry with this reading is that the Book 2 account doesn't give any additional explanation of an inner continuous and simple self. Far from contributing glue to the construction of a fiction of such a self, neither the perfectly simple unitary self nor its fiction or idea are further discussed. Yet a notion of self or person does figure at the very center of Hume's moral psychology and account of the passions. This raises the question of what the fiction that would be strengthened by taking the passions in account is supposed to be a fiction of. Would it be that of a unitary, simple, incorporeal, inner self or mind? Let me call it, staying as close as possible to Hume's own terminology, a philosophical idea of self. Or would it be that of an enduring, embodied person, an identity in the latter case that presupposes the fiction of a continued identity of the complex and changing human body, whose parts, like those of other animals, are related to each other and some common end. We could call the latter the natural self, which, as it turns out, is also a moral self or person. If one were to opt for the first alternative, one might think that this fiction cannot, as such, be corroborated by the passions, which are impressions of reflection. Passions originate from feeling and the senses, not from thinking alone. Moreover, they are constantly changing. They are the actual reactive impressions of a sentient, desiring being, arising from impressions of sensation like pain and pleasure, which depend on the constitution of the body and the action of external objects on its organs. The idea of a self whose unity is supported by the passions must be a self in the larger sense, the natural or moral self. This, it seems to me, is supported by Hume's last metaphor of the human mind as a republic, which offers a better way of understanding how the Book 2 account of passions could complete the Book 1 account of self-identity. What it completes, I suggest, is not a fiction of a perfectly unitary and simple self, but what Hume, at the end of the discussion of personal identity, calls the true idea of self. Insofar as it is called true, this idea is not an improved or stronger version of a fictitious inner self given to mental introspection. There is no perfect simplicity or unproblematic unity, real or feigned, in Hume's true idea of self as a republic or commonwealth. Yet the republic still clearly has more of unity and continuity than a heap, bundle, or theater of passing perceptions. It makes more reason for other. It makes more sense for other reasons too, to think of our identity with regard to the passions as supporting whatever imperfect unity or identity the imagination supplies. For our identity with regard to the passions is anchored in this present concern we have for our past or future pains or pleasures, concern which itself is a form of desire, one of the direct passions in Hume's account, and as much subject to variations as are the changing conditions of the body causing any other passions. This self-concern seems to be, in addition to memory, another fact about our nature as complex, passionate, and reflective animals that Hume simply takes for granted without ever arguing for it. To the third section, I will turn to Hume's account of the passions and get back to the Republic in the last section. But Hume here, as so often elsewhere, leans on facts of nature or original endowments, tends to be neglected in discussions of his theory, partly because so much, in my view, unnecessary weight is given to a claim that he makes in quote G, that passions are original existence containing no representative quality. I'm not going to read it. taken together with another passage where Hume characterizes passions, for example, love and hate, as simple impressions which cannot be defined but are clearly known from our common feeling or experience. It has been taken as evidence that passions for Hume are non-intentional, simple and brute feeling states. Original existence is here often taken as opposed to being a representational idea or having a cognitive content. Although the impressions of reflection that constitute the passions may in themselves, qua impressions, be acts, be existence or modifications of existence, that is, existential facts as opposed to representational ideas, they are, as I read them, neither simple nor unrelated brute atomic facts, but are complex phenomena depending on specific bodily cum cognitive causes. If they do not represent, in the sense ideas copying impressions do, they can have contents or objects just as primary impressions or sensory perceptions have contents. Consider Hume's account of perceptions that he divides into two main kinds, impressions and ideas, the latter being copies of the former. The impressions are subdivided into original and secondary. The former are also called impressions of sensation, and the latter impressions of reflection. The former, the sensations, are called original impressions because they have no mental antecedents. However, they have causes, for Hume explains as a good Cartesian. They arise, I quote, they arise in the soul from the constitution of the body, from the animal spirits, or from the application of objects to the external organs. Hume's analysis concerns passions qua secondary, or what he also calls reflective impressions and ideas, which have original impressions or other ideas as their causes and objects. They can be said to inherit their content from their mental causes that they are reactions to or reflect, just as sense impressions inherit theirs from their causes, from the object affecting the sense organ. Passions are, for Descartes, for Hume as for Descartes and Spinoza, irreducibly psychophysical phenomena. Hume writes in quote, do we have only, I don't seem to have the fourth page, but I think it's quote H. Yeah, on the fourth page, yes, H. Bodily pains and pleasures are the source of many passions, both when felt and considered by the mind, but arise originally in the soul or in the body, whichever way you please to call it, without any preceding thought or perception, end quote. It doesn't matter, Hume seems to say, whether we call it soul or body. For all we know, they could be the same thing. He continues with his example, quote, a fit of gout produces a long train of passions as grief, hope, fear, but is not derived immediately from any affection or idea, end quote. Bodily affections are among the causes of the passions, but passions also, and importantly, have objects. In his general survey of passions, Hume divides them into direct and indirect. The former are such as arise, I quote, immediately from good or evil, and evil, from pain and pleasure. The latter, such as proceed from the same principles but by the conjunction of other qualities, end quote. Hume starts his account with the latter, which are the only ones I will consider here. The first passion he examines in Book Two is pride, which has the self as an object, and moreover is a socially conditioned passion. For how we come to view ourselves in feeling pride or humility depends on how we appear to and take other persons to view us. Our qualities, belongings, or things we take to be somehow related to ourselves, our nation or favorite presidential candidate. Pride and humility, along with the other indirect passions, love and hate, have persons, ourselves or others, as their object. In explaining the double relation principle causing these, Hume refers to instincts or even organs of the mind, connecting impressions and ideas in various systematic, predetermined ways. He even talks about secondary impressions, that is, passions, as innate. But to review, all passions arise directly or indirectly from good and evil, from pain and pleasure, presupposing a living, striving being endowed with organs for perceiving its environment, pursuing what is good and pleases it, or avoiding what is harmful, endowed in addition with a concern for and ability to keep track of her reactions proper to persons. Pride and humility for Hume have the same object, and this object, he writes, is, I quote, self or that succession of related ideas and impressions of which we have an intimate memory and consciousness, end quote. Later on, having spent the first 9 sections of Book 2 on pride and humility, Hume turns to the other indirect passions, that is, love and hate, noting that they too have objects in text I. As the immediate object of pride and humility is self, or that identical person of whose thoughts, actions and sensations we are intimately conscious, so the object of love and hatred is some other person of whose thoughts, actions and sensations we are not conscious. Clearly, the reading of Hume's passions as non-intentional raw fields is in need of revision. But what should we say about the objects of indirect passions, of the idea of self as a succession of related impressions, with its corollary that the idea of a unitary self is a fiction? The idea of a simple, substantial inner self may be a fiction, but does it follow that there is no enduring, howsoever changing self persisting over time? In the passage cited above, Hume claims that the object of, I quote, of our, what he calls our intimate memory or consciousness of self, is a succession of related ideas and impressions. Insofar as there is some self that intimate consciousness or memory reveals, it is a system of related perceptions, not a fiction of a simple and changing entity, so not a fictitious self. That is, it is not an idea of an inner unitary self. Hume uses the term self interchangeably with person to refer to one's own as well as other persons, humans or animals whose thoughts and memories we have no direct access to, but whose character and actions we can observe as they observe ours. Hume's selves or persons, as they appear in the rest of the treatise, are embodied selves. The self that Hume presupposes is neither an underlying metaphysical entity nor a fictive logical construction out of distinct perceptions, but this particular sentient and thinking person of flesh and bones, appearing and evolving in space and time and thriving only in a certain kind of natural and social environment. Hume, as we saw in his metaphor of the theatre, notes that the perceptions appearing there, about the perceptions appearing there, that they pass, repass, glide away and mingle in an infinite variety of postures and situations. Not only do perceptions mingle, they come in different postures and situations, which are retained by and repeated by memory. Among the perceptions gliding by and mingling with each other in the bundle are perceptions of extended things, including complex ones, such as embodied human persons. From the observation that our self, I quote, independent of every other object is really nothing, end quote, Hume goes on to explain neglecting here his own book, One Method of Inspecting Only Perceptions, I quote, "For which reason we must turn our view to external objects, and it is natural for us to consider with most attention such as lie contiguous to us or resemble us." We are constantly looking for objects resembling us, other persons, and it's by attending to the latter and their reactions to us, or our behavior and our passions reacting to theirs, that our sense of self develops and acquires some stability. Let me finally take a closer look now at the true idea of the mind that Hume introduces towards the end of his treatment of personal identity at the end of book one. As we already saw, the true idea is, I quote, the whole text is also quoted in J on the handout, is to consider it as a system of different perceptions or different existences which are linked together by the relation of cause and effect and mutually produce, destroy, influence and modify each other. In this respect, he says at the end of the quote, "I cannot compare the soul more properly to anything than to a republic or commonwealth, in which the several members are united by the reciprocal ties of government and subordination, and give rise to other persons who propagate the same republic in the incessant change of its parts." There's a lot to comment on in this passage, and it's worth reading carefully. First, we are now talking of the true idea of the self, not just any fiction. Second, what was earlier described as a mere mass or bundle is now pictured as a structured, dynamic system of interrelated powers, where stronger and more lively perceptions chase out and destroy weaker ones, those which do not support or subject themselves to the authority of the stronger ones, or contribute to preserving the system as a whole. Here, as later, Hume refers carelessly to the human mind, the soul, and the person. Why would he choose a political analogy to illustrate this entity or its idea? To introduce a modern republican version, perhaps, of Plato's Republic, a version where individual idea members and their mutual power relations replace those of the three fixed, hierarchically ordered parts of the Platonic soul. One reason why Hume would call it a true idea rather than a fiction could be that it introduces the idea of stable, repeated patterns of relation among its changing individual members, based on reciprocal ties of government and subordination. Relations that Hume himself may have thought of as reducible to a form of causation, but which clearly involve considerations going beyond mere efficient causation. Not only are its members said to be united by ties of government and subordination, but moreover, their union is said to give rise to other persons propagating the same republic in the incessant changes of its parts. There's a ordered union of its members so structured that although the individual perceptions forming it are ever changing, their interrelations are stable enough to produce new perceptions contributing to uphold it as the same person or system. If we take the political analogy seriously, we might think that this order or structure rests on some accepted and mutually recognized hierarchy between its members. Now look at the Republic metaphor again, and the last text, M, on the handout. And as the same individual republic may not only change its members, but also its laws and constitutions, in like manner, the same person may vary his character and disposition as well as his impressions and ideas without losing his identity. Hume singles out the relation of causation as that which in the end holds its parts together. How does causation work here? It can hardly be a matter of reducing causality to a mere brute succession of perceptions. The causal history, presumably, is a history of political institutions and events too, so a political history, a history of its mode of government, bonds, covenants, transactions, and their regulations. Analogously, the story of the succession of ideas making up an individual human mind or person must be a moral story, but to adapt to a moral story, more than mere resemblance and succession of the items connected must be at play. The same person, Hume writes, may vary his character and disposition without losing his identity. Character and dispositions may be more stable than passing ideas, as the constitution and laws of a republic are, but the latter allow of variation too, so something else must account for its enduring, however imperfect, identity. It is here at this point in the text where Hume mentions the second aspect again. Our identity with regard to the passions serves to corroborate that with regard to the imagination. There's a wide variety of readings of how this is supposed to happen. I will end by sketching another attempt to make sense of this. The relations of causation and resemblance trace a history between causally connected passing sets of ideas, including ideas of one's present and past actions, emotional reactions, and interrelations with other persons, forming threads or patterns in the web constituting the idea of a person's identity. The dynamics of passions, which are modifications or determinate expressions of her desire, strengthen and corroborate this web through their force and vivacity and the greater liveliness they transfer to the sets of perception associated to them. A present impression of sadness or pain evokes and connects with similar past experiences, bringing related past saddening ideas or beliefs to the mind, increasing its pain. The vivacity of reflective impressions and their ideas is transferred through the semblance from one set of perceptions to another, forming more or less stable patterns of interrelated emotional reactions, beliefs and images of actions that are repeated in memory and that we recognize as our own. The concern for self that guides the selection of ideas or sets of ideas that keep recurring in the causal network is set by nature. It's original or innate in Hume's sense of these terms. So is the concern we show as social and moral animals for each other, for the past and future pains or pleasures of our fellow persons. A person's place or rank in the social political hierarchy are equally important, just as the identity and stability of the Republic as a political community whose members expel and replace one another depends on not only on their mutual relations of subordination, but also on the territory claimed by it as its own and the recognition by other communities of its territorial bounds and possessions. The mind depends on the body just as the Republic depends on its recognized territory and location, which may be one of the reasons why Hume prefers the Republic as the true idea of the human mind, better than, for instance, the mental theater, which has no determinate spatial location. On the reading here defended, the comparison of the mind to a political system with its reference to the Platonic soul and its hierarchy of rational governors, helpers, and slaves is even more important. Hume rejects its predetermined hierarchy of parts and famously reverses the order, casting reason in the role of slave. He may in the end be closer to that of Spinoza and more in tune with the early modern view of nature as a dynamic plenum of forces, where the human mind too is seen as a collection of conflicting forces or ideas asserting themselves with various degrees of causal vivacity and causal power. yet it retains the idea of a regulated whole of interrelated parts. With repeatable reciprocal ties of dominion and subordination between its various individual idea members, which are struggling to maintain themselves and the stability of the community they belong to. Those who fail to collaborate or who oppose its ends are expelled, while those who manage to stay in power can do so only to the extent that they get some recognition and support from subordinate members or the coalitions they have entered into. None of this is to say that the Republic grounds a better fiction of a simple unitary thing. It is a true idea precisely because it's neither simple nor strictly unitary, but rather a complex metaphor picturing a complex, messy, physical and moral, socio-political, constantly changing, but still enduring entity more true to the reality of the phenomenon. As such, the Republic or person cannot be constituted by mere causal connections between distinct and related inner parts or elements. The latter must already be related to each other in some determinate ways within the limits set by their embodied and social natures. Facts that Hume's empiricist moral science is good at observing and taking into account, but cannot really explain, at least not using mere laws of association of ideas. Thank you.